Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. I want to talk to you about the Bose S1, which is an amazing speaker for acoustic guitar gigs that I recently got to test drive. The S1 has two separate channels. It's got one for guitar and one for microphone, and there's a third channel you can use for a looper or for backing tracks that you can access by Bluetooth or through a 1/8 inch input. And the S1 is actually portable and rechargeable for up to 11 hours. So the guitar and mic channels, they have separate independent tone, volume, and reverb controls, and they also have something called a proprietary tone match switch, which EQs, optimizes, and restores the natural sound of your acoustic guitar, which, as you know, is typically your biggest problem when you're playing acoustic amps. I tested the S1 speaker, and it's very responsive to pickups, and the tone, volume, and reverb controls genuinely work great. You can position the S1 four different ways. You can tilt it back to broadcast out to an audience, or you can put it horizontally, vertically, or on a stand. The S1 also has a proprietary Bose accelerometer, which automatically adjusts the EQ and optimizes the sound based on whichever one of these four positions you're using. So effectively, you have an acoustic guitar amp, a PA, and a killer Bluetooth speaker all in one. So the bottom line is, if you're an acoustic player, there's absolutely nothing out there that sounds this good and this big, that's portable and battery powered. And the S1 also happens to be the best Bluetooth speaker Bose makes, which says a lot. I used it myself for a party we had here one night, and it was absolutely amazing. All my kids were freaking out. It's like having a full stereo system out on your patio. You can easily use this for DJing, tailgating, or whatever you want. Before this, you'd have to spend thousands of dollars on a bunch of equipment to get the same thing the S1 does. On top of that, it's sleek and it looks great, just like all Bose devices do. And besides whatever money back guarantee you get from wherever you buy the S1, Bose also warranties the S1 for 2 years from any kind of defects in materials or performance. For more information and to find out where to get your own S1, I'd like you to go to pro.bose.com/podcast. Check it out at pro.bose.com/podcast and get the S1. It's outstanding. This is an important announcement for anyone thinking about advertising here on Everyone Loves Guitar. We've experienced incredible growth. We currently have over 82,000 monthly listens, and I would anticipate cracking six figures in the next few months. We've also grown our YouTube subscriber base by 72 times. During this time, we've kept our advertising rates consistent, but I wanted to let you know we'll be increasing these rates after the first of the new year. So if you're a business looking to generate new leads or increase your cash flow by adding new clients or customers, or if you're looking for general brand exposure, or if you're a label looking to promote new music and you want to lock into the current advertising rates before they go up at the end of this year, then listen closely. Fill in the short form at everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Even if you want to advertise next year, contact us now and you'll get to lock into the current rates before they go up at the end of this year. Thanks for listening. See you soon.
If you want to buy or sell a home or investment property and you're here in the Tampa Bay area in Hillsboro, Pinellas, or Pasco counties, then listen up. West Florida Real Estate is a local residential real estate broker that's helped over 250 Bay Area homeowners buy and sell their properties in the last 4 years alone. If you're looking to sell, you'll want to get their free report, The 7 Biggest Mistakes Homeowners Make When Hiring a Realtor. And if you're looking to buy a property, you definitely want to get your hands on The 21 Most Expensive Mistakes Tampa Home Buyers Make When Buying a Home. Each one of these reports is going to save you time and money. Inside, you'll discover the 7 most important things to consider when hiring a realtor, what to do if you're buying and selling a home at the same time, and the danger of choosing a realtor who agrees with everything you say. To get your hands on these free reports, head on over to westfloridarealestate.com. That's westfloridarealestate.com.
Hey, this is Craig. If you like this show and you want to support it and you want to keep it free, head on over to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/support.
Hey, this is Craig. Today's interview with Amy Ray is something that I first recorded probably close to 6 months ago. It was initially supposed to be the first part of a two-part interview because her time is so tight. But the reality is there won't be a second part. I mean, as it is, she never does interviews this long. They're extremely brief, and she was very kind. She is obviously part of two very successful bands, her own solo career and the Indigo Girls, and she writes music and plays music in both. She leads a band in her solo career. And on top of that, she's a mom with a small child, and she owns a record company. So fair enough that she couldn't have any more time to do it. But rather than letting this sit on the shelf collecting dust, I wanted to get it out there and get you to enjoy it. It's a really good interview. It's very interesting. And hey, it's Amy Ray. She's a very articulate, very bright woman. We had a ton of fun together, and I think you're going to enjoy it. So take care. Thanks for listening, and enjoy Amy Ray. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And I've got just a wonderful, just incredibly talented woman that I was lucky enough to meet and see in concert. I was lucky enough to see her in concert and meet her. And with the one and only Amy Ray, I just want to give a quick shout out to Jeff Fielder, because Jeff really kind of made this happen. I went to go see Jeff. I interviewed him, and tremendous guitar player, and he's in Amy's band. Real quick, if you don't know Amy, I'll give you a real quick background. She started playing back in high school in Atlanta, Georgia, when she and Emily Saliers formed the duo that would become the Indigo Girls. The story started in 81. They had a basement tape called Tuesday's Children, and they went on to include a deal with Epic Records in 88, a Grammy in 90, and 20 albums over more than 30 years. God, this sounds like you're about 70 years old.
I am about 70 years old.
You've done about three lifetimes worth of work here in a short period of time. As activists, they've supported many great causes, from LGBTQ rights to voter registration. And they also co-founded an environmental justice organization called Honor the Earth with Winona LaDuke in 93. As artists, they've dipped their toes into a similar multitude of waters: folk, rock, country, pop, and more, but the resulting releases are always pure indigo. I'm going to cut out the rest of all this because we're pressed for time, and I'll just tell you this. Amy is a badass. She's an incredible writer, a really great, deep songwriter, really nice person. I will read the last paragraph that I wrote here. Is Amy pays more attention to her fans in the audience than maybe anyone I've seen in concert. In the short time I spoke with her, because we chatted after the show, she was kind, patient, and curious, and I've been looking forward to this since then. So thank you very much. And I don't blow smoke up people's asses. That's genuine. So there you
Thanks,
go.
Thanks, Craig.
Thank you. Thanks for coming on. So one of the things I really enjoy about your music is your songwriting. The music's very fulfilling, is very well written, and the lyrics are very substantive. What do you like writing? What do you like best about writing songs?
Oh, wow. The whole thing is like a journey for me. Part of it is learning more about melody, and I like to play around with them. I think a long time ago when I started writing, I was like thinking it had to be this mystical thing the whole time, and the muse had to hit you, and, you know, and I didn't realize it was like a discipline. And I think, and then I kind of shifted probably about 20 years ago when I started making solo records. That really forced me to shift my ideas about writing. And I read a bunch of books about writing. I read a book by Stephen King called On Writing that really shifted my whole universe. Yeah. About that. And it gave me a discipline. And then it was kind of like work for a while. And then I started just enjoying the playfulness of like changing chords under, like having the same melody, but changing the chords underneath it, that, and like hearing how it shifts things around, or like playing around with, you know, taking verses in and out and just not being too precious on it, and realizing that it should be, like not only like an emotional activity, but an intellectual kind of activity in a way too, you know? So I sort of look at songs, you know, at first when I'm writing, I don't censor myself, and I just kind of, everything's like stream of consciousness, and it just comes out. And then I go back and listen to the tapes and make notes and sort of make note of what I like and what I didn't like. And then I start crafting it like in more of a songwriter kind of craft way. And that part of the process I used to hate.
What do you mean? The editing?
Yeah, because it's so, it just felt laborious and like,
it is.
It was like writing a term paper to me and from college, you know, but now I like it. I mean, I look at it like a, it's like a little haven and a little bit of time for me to kind of just play around and be right in the moment, you know, and I just sort of shut everything else out and focus. And it makes me a better songwriter too, you know, to enjoy it instead of just look at it as a chore, you know. But it is a discipline, and I do find that it's a muscle that you need to exercise constantly.
Does, I mentioned before, your band is, your current band is just mind, really, really great. I mean, they're tight. They're all really good musicians. When you're writing now that you have these, like, all these arrows in your quiver, because you could now think about, well, Jeff could do this. Do you think about now how that could expand with these guys? And does that give you more freedom as a writer, or?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. Like, because when I write, I think, you know, some people write and they just write, but I actually think about who the song is going to be collaborated with, you know. So if I can hear Emily in my head, you know, I'll write in an Indigo Girl way, and I will be thinking about, like, oh, we can do these counter melodies and we can write these harmonies. And with the solo band, they are such great players, and, I mean, they're all, like, I've played with them for about 5 years now, and I noticed at some point, you know, after we made our first record together, when we made Goodnight Tender, it was basically the bass player changed, but he came on board pretty early, and so he's been with us for about 5 years, and everybody else has been together, and I think all of a sudden I realized in my writing I was starting to hear them and think about them, and it changed the way I wrote for Holler quite a bit, because I they're a family, you know, and I knew what they could do. And I mean, they're like really great players. And then on Holler, I also had a guest player. I had Allison Brown come in and play banjo, and she's a virtuoso. And so that opened up a lot of area for me as far as like knowing that there was a banjo player that could do this almost like Bela Fleck kind of jazz improvisational banjo. Yeah. And then I had Kofi Burbridge playing keyboards, and he's got a whole thing too. So, you know, knowing what the band was going to be sort of influenced the writing. And now when I hear them in my head, and it's like being a kid in a candy store. I mean, they're phenomenal players, and they're fun to listen to. So when I'm touring with them, I'm looking forward to the show because I'm looking forward to what they're going to play, you know, as a fan. And they're on a whole other level from me. So it's just a great learning experience all the time. And I feel like I can just step back and they play, and I don't feel like there's going to be a shift in the attention, the audience. I mean, sometimes when if you're a singer songwriter, you get like a band, quote unquote, that like backs you up. It's like the wrong way to look at it to me. Like I always wanted to have a band that would be as important or more important even than me on stage, so that it doesn't matter if I'm singing or not, or everybody's got a place in the spotlight all the time. That's that's when I'm a fan of somebody, that's what I want to hear. I don't want to go hear a songwriter that has this band behind them that they haven't really thought about that much. It's just kind of playing a bed, you know, of stuff for them to sing over so that it's louder or something. I want to have like this experience where everybody's important and every part is important, and it feels like a team effort. It doesn't feel like I'm fronting a band. So that's, I got lucky, and that's what I have now. It's like this band that people actually want to hear. You know, it's not like, it's like with Indigo Girls, you know, really hardcore fans sometimes will be like, we'd rather hear you just by yourself, you know? And I know, you know, we don't like that. Like we love bands that play really great, and we love audiences that recognize that. And as a solo artist, I've been really lucky because I've never had that issue with my audience. I think because the band has always been so top notch that people are kind of like, whoa, you know, and I don't ever play by myself either. I never play alone. I always either, I at least have Jeff with me, if nothing else, you know, I don't want to play by myself. You know, I want to, because it's integral to the music. I mean, I wrote it with Jeff, and he was the first kind of person to collaborate with for me. And then the band grew around him. So, you know, he's always in my head, as like a partner in some ways, you know. And then the band started growing around him. And so now it's like, I just always want to play with the band, you know.
You're like I said, you were so good with the audience. It was almost like we're in your living room or something. You know? No, seriously, you were like very, and it, you know, it was just like I said, it was like in your living room. Have you always been like that? It's the first time I've seen you perform.
Yeah. I mean, if the venue and the audience is like that, I'm like that, you know. Okay. There's some shows where the audience is not as interactive. You know, they want to just, I think in the South, you know, it's different because people really want to interact a lot. And then like Jersey's the same way. New Jersey audiences tend to be kind of almost like Southern audiences in a way. There's really like a lot of interaction and conversation. So it depends on the town and the venue and everything. And, so I like that, you know, I like a venue where it's intimate and not, I don't mean the space size, but the feeling of like being able to just talk to people and feel relaxed and just play and like have this rock, punky, country kind of moment together that's sweaty and like a garage. I mean, I always was fascinated by like that whole idea of garage music, you know, where literally setting up in your garage and playing for your friends. And a lot of my friends coming up were in punk bands, and that's what they did, you know, to start with, is they just set up in their garages for real. And friends would come and they would play shows and, you know, they would pass out little flyers about it. And I've always felt like, for me, that's the best way to consume music and also, you know, put it out there. And any space I'm in, I try to make feel like that. And Emily's the same way. Indigo Girls are the same way. It just depends on, you know, the audience and what they want. Some audiences really just want to listen and they don't want to have that give and take energy. And even in that case, it's I think I try to always just find where people are, you know, cause I don't want it to be, there to be that division between performer and audience. I don't really like that space.
You did honestly, and it definitely puts people in my opinion, gets people that much more behind you because it feels like it's almost like a personal concert sort of, you know, and it was,
well, my audiences are pretty small, so it can be that way too, well,
but everybody handles that differently. And you just, it was very warm how you did that. I thought it was really cool, you know, and well, you don't see that very often to that level anyway. So, I mean, it was great. I think it was a skill set.
Good.
Holler, great record. I just want to ask you a question about a couple of songs that I really love. Sure Feels Good Anyway. I know that you don't like me, but it sure feels good.
Oh, wait, I lost
you. You got me? Okay. So yeah. I want to talk about Holler and a couple of the songs I loved on there. Sure Feels Good Anyway. I know that you don't like me, but it sure feels good anyway. I was curious what's that all about and what's the backstory to that?
It can function on a couple of different levels, that particular line. It can be, you know, like I find myself, I'm in a relationship. I'm married, not married, but I'm with somebody permanently and we have a child together. And I don't, marriage is like such a weird concept to me still, even.
Well, you can tell because when you said it, was like,
I don't know. Everybody's like wants to get married and we definitely should have the right to be married, but instead I just kind of legally set everything up so that it would be everybody's protected. Yeah. But anyway, which is something you can do if you have money. And so everyone should be able to get married because everyone can't afford to like do the legal protections you need as a gay person, but that's a whole other subject. But, anyway, so in my relationship, my partner is like, so, she's from the West Coast and, you know, like we are very different in some ways. In a lot of ways we're alike. We have a spiritual center that's similar and a moral compass that's similar. And we love art and there's all the things that you need to be with somebody or there. as far as how we interact and stuff. But she's, I'm really like a, I'm almost like a red, I'm a redneck, you know, with like a radical left perspective. And, but I still have this.
Wait a minute. You know, that's that right there is totally incongruent.
I know, but that's what she has. Right. That's so what's funny. Hard for her.
I'm a redneck like, with a radical left. What?
That's usually, she's like, how can you be, you know, so comfortable in this rural North Georgia space with all these people that are, you know, that just are so faith-based and so, you know, conservative and everything. And I'm just like, this is just, I'm a redneck. I mean, I'm just like, I like these people. I don't agree with a lot of this, but I like sure. where I am. And I like the people up here, and I've always grown up here, and I just have filters or something that makes it work for me, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's what it was kind of like. I know you don't like me, but it sure feels good to be with you anyway, but it's also about that's being cool. here. It's also about being where I am. It's like, I know, you know, it's like my neighbors, you know, I know you don't really like everything I stand for and you may not even like me, but I love where I am. And I don't want, you know, and I want the same ownership over this that you have in a theoretical way. I don't mean like owning land, but like, it's like saying like, you know, you can say that gay people can't be part of the Methodist church, but I grew up Methodist and you're not going to take that from me. It's sure, like sure. this thing, you know, where, and I think like a lot of people that live in rural areas that are, have political values that are more left wing feel that way because you love the land. I mean, I love farming and I love the land and I love the way people up here know how to work with their hands and they can, you know, get out of a bind and they're very self-sufficient. And I just have so much respect for everything about them, my neighbors. And I've lived up here where I live about 25 years. And I went to camp where I live when I was a kid too. So I'm very like immersed in this environment in the North Georgia mountains. And I love the people up here, but I know that there's a rub. There's always a rub because it's, there are so many people that disagree with what I am, but at the same time, I just love being here. And that's really what the song is about. It's like, and it's also calling out people around, you know, hate and intolerance and the Confederate flag and all the issues we've had in my town and racism and, you know, just saying like, you know, at the end of the day, like I know you and you're a good person and you've helped me a lot with when I, you know, like you helped me clear the road with your chainsaw or you helped me shoot a deer that was in distress in my creek and I didn't have a gun to kill it myself or whatever. All these people that are my friends. But then at the same time, when it comes to talking about race or immigration or any these issues that are hotbed issues, pro-life, pro-choice, a lot of these issues where we might differ, it can become so polarizing, but I don't think it should. It doesn't have to. You know, you can say like, there's a core of goodness in people and this other stuff. I mean, racism's probably the hardest thing for me because is there a core of goodness in someone that's really, really racist? I don't know. You know, I find that I want to search for that goodness in anybody. And I find that I am optimistic that people can build bridges and learn. And I mean, I've known people that were so homophobic in against me and over time have just, I mean, well, my parents, you know, I mean, I think because I grew up in the South and I grew up with the more conservative parents who ended up being so loving about everything and such cheerleaders for gay rights. So I see that people can shift and so it gives me a good perspective to have, you know, and that's kind of that song is all about that is my struggle with that and my hope in that context, you know.
Man, that was like so moving, your answer to that. Thank you. This is why I was looking forward to talking to, because I knew this is what would come out. Wow, that was really, you know, it's really interesting. Women, I ask similar questions, not exact same. Women get right into it right away, man. Like they're open up.
Oh, Craig, I lost you. Wait, say that again. Say that again. Women, I lost you on. I ask women.
Women get into it right away. They open up immediately, like about seriously deep shit sometimes. It's just some, and it's 100%, it's not 50%, it's not 75%, it's 100% of the women I interview get into stuff much quicker. They open up, and it's just like, it's really obvious to me how different women and men are since I've been interviewing people. Because it's, I mean,
really?
Oh my God. Yeah.
Well, maybe there's some guys that you could interview that are like that too, probably.
Some guys do. But like, for example,
you think it takes longer?
It takes longer. But plus also, if you look at like just raw statistics, the amount of guys with screwed up shit going on in their life cannot be less than the amount of women with screwed up shit.
Yeah,
right?
It cannot
be. It's just
yeah.
statistically impossible.
Yeah.
Yet every woman I talk to opens up about the nutty shit that they've had to deal with. Maybe 15% of the guys I talk to.
Well, you know, that's like society is just like taught men that they can't.
But
you
I'm
know.
Talking to musicians. Most musicians are pretty.
I know,
I mean,
but they're
they come
still,
around,
still
they're
been,
vulnerable. Ultimate, but it's never like, bam. I mean, right away.
But, well, they've still been brought up in the in if it's America, they've still been brought up in a world where even if you're an artist, if you're a guy, you've been socialized a certain way. You know.
It's just I find it's really refreshing though to have a conversation like this, and I don't have to wait like 30 minutes to get into it. You know, it's like it's almost like, you know what I mean. It's like the meter's
That's
running,
funny.
And then when it's and then okay, now it's time to be vulnerable.
So That's funny.
Thank you for that answer. That was really cool. The other song that was really powerful was "Didn't Know a Damn Thing." Super intense lyrics. Is that somewhat like autobiographical? Sort of along the lines of some of the stuff you talked about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, I'm obsessed with racism, right? Like in my life as a Southerner, I think it's just kind of my mission to like gain more knowledge, self knowledge about that, or knowledge generally, and read a lot, just try to shift the paradigm. I think it's part of the legacy of living in the South and reparations that you make. I mean, it's probably part of the legacy of living in the U.S. because the more I read about racism, the more I realize that the South did not have a monopoly on it, you know. And when you think about like slave ships and slave trade, and like a lot of the slave traders were from up north and were coming down and using crews from the South. I mean, it's amazing. The more you read about this, the South has been a place of like total ugliness around that, but also complete activism around it, and a dialogue that's been open for a long time. And so, and we've been forced to confront it. So I think this song is about like the need, like when I was growing up, what I realized, when I was reading some books this past few years, and I was looking at my life as I was growing up, and I realized that like, I didn't know what was going on around me, you know, because I think as a kid, when I was growing up, you're not privy to that dialogue necessarily. You're sheltered from it, you know, until a certain age when it's appropriate, you know, but because you don't have the groundwork, it takes longer to catch up on that conversation about race. You know, if you were brought up when I was born in 64. So, you know, the schools at that time were really careful about the way they talked about race, and church was very sheltered. And I think you could think that you were being a really good person and, you know, dotting your I's and crossing your T's, but you didn't know the half of it, you know? And so I think the song is just kind of takes me through my life down here, like growing up in Atlanta, and the different things that were happening in my life, and kind of taking myself to task, you know, and saying like, wow, I thought I was such a, even as a kid, I thought I was like so progressive, and I just didn't even know the half of it. And even now, you know, you don't like, you can, there's always like, there's, you know, in the South, like we talk about race a lot, which is a great thing. And we have this way of dialoguing, but there's this other thing going under, it's an undercurrent all the time of like the things that we aren't talking about, that we won't admit yet, you know, and it's hard for us, I think, to face up to them. And I think it's even harder for some people in other parts of the country. I think like on the West Coast, you know, there's like a sort of a quietness about the hard stuff, like about race. And
it's quiet in general on the West Coast about everything, right? Isn't it? It's always like everything is sunshine and roses, it seems.
Well, I don't think it's, I think it's just a different, I mean, I guess if you talk to someone in Oakland, they wouldn't say that because they're such great activists there, but there's a sort of like, there's a level, there's, I think in every area, there's probably like this spectrum of polite kind of conversation, not just in the West Coast, but everywhere probably, where, you know, we're progressive, but it's because we don't really have to confront anything.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's what the, I think that's what, when you talk about people that are really like in the Trump world, and they're, you know, people I know that are like really for Trump and stuff, the thing that they get so frustrated about is that polite society, is all these people talking about how important immigration is and all this stuff, but they never have to confront it because they live in a white world and they don't really have conflict in their life and they don't have to think deeper about this. And it's like, I think they feel like, you're so elitist. Would you really feel this way if you were in this environment instead? You know, we're in our world. And I think that that's the disconnect. And I'm not saying that that it's right to feel the things that people feel. I'm saying that, that what's right is to have empathy and to try to understand why people feel that way. And I think the division is that, and I think the frustration is sometimes like, well, that's easy for you to say, you know, make like $250,000 a year. You live in a completely whitewashed environment and your kids go to this private school and everything seems like it's all rosy and great. But, you know, I'm dealing with all this other stuff that, that feels, you know, rough to me because of these things. Mm-hmm. So, and I think a lot about that, obviously. And I think, some of the songs sometimes reflect me trying to find a place of empathy and my own, and with it, I find that by looking at my own shortcomings and realizing where I can connect, you know.
Yeah. I'll tell you a funny story. So I'm from the Bronx where everybody was of color and tons of gay people. Rednecks scared the shit out of me. Until I've been living in the South a long time now, but that, you know, that was a, you know,
I know, right?
Yeah, that was a trip for me. You know, I'd go to like South Jersey and I'd be like, what?
You know who scared me is white frat boys.
Oh yeah, well those guys are just
We all have like this conditioning that we're scared of, right? So I'd be always like, if I was in a dark alley and I met a white frat boy,
well, those guys scare me too. They're just like, no, honestly, it's just like total like macho. There's no brains going. It's like, you know, it's entitlement, you know.
Well, sure, but then you meet some nice ones and you're like,
yeah, right.
You know what I'm saying? It's like,
right. It's just a stereotype, but you know, they scared me too. but anyway, I want to tell everybody, I'd like you to check out Amy's latest album called Holler, and all the songs in there are great. And start with Didn't Know a Damn Thing and Sure Feels Good Anyway. Really beautiful stuff. What were some of maybe the lower points or the dark periods you've had to deal with, and how'd you get through them?
Oh God. I mean, I've had a lot of low points, and I mean, I get depressed real easily. I mean, I definitely have had depression and anxiety problems my whole life. And so I'm always dipping in and dipping out of that world, you know, and trying to just, you know, the way I get out of it is usually by going out and being in the middle of trees. I mean, before I moved to the woods, for like, it was like 25 years ago, I lived in a city. I lived in Decatur, Georgia. And when I got depressed, like, you know, I would drink, you know, and I just couldn't, I really couldn't find a way to heal that until I moved up to, and then I realized it was just like, I just needed to be in a place that was like the woods, like to go out and hike. Hmm. Everybody needs different things. And I stopped drinking it was like the ticket to learning how to heal myself. Right. And I think I had my first year in college, I was at Vanderbilt in Nashville. And it was in 83. And so it was like the Reagan years. Right. And that college, my sister had gone there. So I thought I wanted to, cause she was so cool. And when she was there, it was like kind of a different place almost, but it was experiencing a really conservative time. And I was figuring out I was gay and I had a girlfriend and, you know, just suicidal. I mean, I just was like so bad off and like trying to muscle through and couldn't. And I mean, there were some things that were good. I worked at a used record store that I really loved and I loved the owners there. And I amassed an incredible comic book and record collection. but and I played racquetball all the time. But I was really depressed. I mean, it was a dark time for me. It was, you know, and I just pulled myself out of it by leaving Vanderbilt and moving back to Atlanta and going to Emory. And Emily and I were still, Indigo Girls were still playing together. We, even when we were at different schools, we played together in the summer and on the weekends and on breaks and stuff. And it was a continuing thing. But we could really, when we got back, both of us ended up at Emory in Atlanta and we could really focus on it. And I think that helped save me. I think music definitely helped save me. But I think it does, it was more of a struggle than I thought. At the time, like when I look back on it, I realize how much I was struggling around being gay and also being masculine and just so different in my body than most women are, and just how to just be in the world like that. And because when you're a kid, you know, it feels you're a tomboy and it just feels free, you know, and but then you hit puberty and then your sexuality starts setting in and your gender, and it's just confusing, you know, and I think it's confusing for everybody. I don't think it's whether you're straight or you're gay or whatever. So for me, it kind of interacted with my, my lack of filters for the world, and, you know, just anything would get to me, and sadness of the world and bad things that would happen. And I just took on a lot, you know, all the time. So I think that was a dark time for me, but music pretty much saved me because I could find my people in that world and just not just playing gigs, but more like going to gigs, like going to see people play and finding community around that. And even in Nashville, when I was having such a hard time, the people that I turned to were like the owners of the music, of the record store, because one of them was a great songwriter and had been, it was an older man and he'd been published, and he was a real mentor who had written a lot of hit songs. And also just, I think he knew, he had known my older sister and he knew what I was like and what I was going through. And he didn't even know probably half the times that he was super helpful. So a lot of it was just that, like having the right mentors and stuff. But that was really that was the hardest point in my life. Like it was just, you know, leaving high school, getting into college, trying to understand my political perspective and my activist perspective and my sexuality and my gender and all that all at once, you know, and also trying to learn. I mean, college is hard in that way, I think. But I also think I could have, you know, I could have taken a year off before I had gone and maybe been better off. But I was lucky to get to go. I mean, I know like a lot of my friends did not go to college and they wanted to, they just couldn't afford it, you know? And so for me now, I look back on it and I think, those are dark times, but I'm lucky I got to go, you know, honestly. But in the music world, Emily and we had like 1 year that was pretty hard, like right after everything hit and our career kind of started taking off, and we just had a lot going on career-wise, and I think it was hard on both of us to like just stay down to earth and like communicate correctly. And so that was a dark time in our partnership of really just learning how to talk to each other and be okay. But we had a couple of blow-ups, and then we sort of just talked about like what would change that, you know? And so we were like, okay, we won't tour for longer than 3 weeks at a time. You know, like there were things that we decided with each other that would make it easier in our careers to not be crazy. And a lot of it was around like how much we would tour and sort of to do with things that would help us feel grounded, just sort of hotels and how we run our business and what place activism would have. And a lot of things that helped us sort of stay fueled and interested and evolving. And so that conversation and having that kind of mission statement almost in a way helped me navigate that time. And so for me, getting, you know, that was all like part of my youth in a way. And then I my dad died 5 years ago, and that was super hard because it was a total shocker for me, because he was I mean, he was kind of like a bionic man. Like he had a pacemaker and like a defibrillator in his like machine kind of in his chest that would like start his heart back up when it stopped. But he was in really good shape and like a handyman and retired doctor, but like mostly like a chemist and a hobbyist and built things. And he did, you know, like one day he's out chopping wood and the next day he had a stroke and died. And it was just like a crazy thing. And everybody's, you know, it's, we all have to deal with it. You know, it's like this common thing, but you're never ready for it. And so that he died. And then my daughter was born 10 days later. And, it was, it was like, and I had a record that had just come out. My solo record, Goodnight Tender, had just come out too. And so there were all these things happening that were dark and light at the same time.
Yeah.
So that was a bit of a struggle for me to like figure out how to be grieve and be so happy to have a child that I wanted for so long. But I don't know how I got through that actually. Just I wrote a lot and I tried to be a good partner, and probably my kid is what got me through it the most. Is I just needed to be, I knew I needed to be a good parent. And I didn't want all the darkness of that grief to leak out too much. Yeah. But at the same time, I wanted to be honest about it, you know. But, you know, what does a 6-month-old know about that, right? I mean, and they feel you. They feel you. And they can feel your pain and your stress. So I have a really close friend who would come over and hold, I mean, my partner was around all the time, but my friend Tanner would come over and hold Ozzy and just talk to her and like say, you know, she would kind of help. She's like, you know, if you feel sad and you're holding her and you get frustrated and angry because she won't stop crying, like you just need to like laugh, you know, and like smile and like fake it till you make it kind of thing. And she taught me a lot. I mean, she's never had kids, but she has an energy. She's been through a lot and has an energy that just, and so I counted on my friends to sort of model behavior for me. And I talked to my mom a lot and helped her through her grief, which I think helped me through mine, you know? So things like that. I mean, it's, as you get older, you lose a lot of people, and that's the thing. And it's an ongoing thing. Mm. And it's weird because I think, you don't get used to it, but it just is a stage of life, you know? So your parents start passing away. Your friends get sick. It's just like this endless thing. Your heroes are dying, you know, in the rock and roll world. And,
right.
You know, so for me now, I like try to redirect all the time to gratitude. Not to not feel things, but just to be thankful for them.
Thank you so much for sharing. I give you a lot of credit for a few things, though. Mostly for realizing you had choices. So like when you said, you know, you didn't say, well, shit, I'm going to stick here in Vanderbilt. I got to fix, you said, you know what? I don't need to be here. Let me go someplace else to be happy. You said, I don't need to sit in the city. Let me go out to the country. I give you credit for that. Cause you were able to think like, you know, not until later in life didn't realize that I just like soldiered on through all this shit. So I give you a lot of credit for that. Cause you made your life happier, you know?
Hey, yeah.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.